We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla Visa gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank, MetaBank, and Sutton Bank, members FDIC, pursuant to a license from Visa USA, Inc., and may be used in the U.S. everywhere Visa debit cards are accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services. NMLS ID number 912772.
We're here for the next episode of the Palisades Podcast. This is our attempt to shed light on the interesting, innovative, creative people who live in Pacific Palisades so that everyone in the community will know a little bit more about some of the leaders and icons in our community. And today we're lucky to have with us Sam Lagana. Before we start, I'm Steve Crone.
And I'm Brooke Dougherty.
And thank you for joining us. I'm going to give you just a little introduction about Sam's background, and then we're going to go back and talk about his life, how he got here, what makes up the person that we're talking to today, what he's done, what he plans to do in the future. So Sam is the kind of guy that when you look at his resume, you wonder, how does one person accomplish so much in his lifetime? For me to give you a bullet point of his everything he's done would take us more time than we have today. So let me give you just a few highlights, and then we'll start talking with Sam. He is currently Associate Vice Chancellor at Pepperdine University, in charge of fundraising for the university. He is also actively involved in philanthropy for other groups. He is actively involved in the sports world. His most interesting recent endeavor is that he is now the stadium voice for our new Los Angeles Rams. I think of them as new because they've only been here for a while, even though I grew up with them. He's also the executive director of the very prestigious John R. Wooden Award, which is a national award to the outstanding collegiate basketball player. He is on the Association of Volleyball Professionals. He is, I could go on and on. In our community, he was at one point named Businessman of the Year. He was given a Spark Plug Award. We could go on and on, but I'm going to let Sam tell you the rest. So welcome, Sam.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys.
Glad to have you. Now that people who didn't know much about you have a little idea, I'd like to go back and talk to you about how you got to the Palisades. Where'd you grow up? Tell me a little bit about your family and go from there.
Well, I would say everything started at 14996 Lecumbre Drive, which is the house I grew up in.
Wow.
And my father and mother both were from the city of Trenton, New Jersey, where they went to Trenton Central High School, and they were from an Italian ghetto portion of the city known as Chambersburg. My father was one of nine children and the descendant of a gentleman, my grandfather, who immigrated from Reggio Calabria in 1900 at the age of 15 and was a railroad worker. And all of my father's brothers worked on the railroad. His sisters stayed at home and went on to meet their husbands and became mothers and good women of Trenton, New Jersey, never drove cars and were just stayed in their community. And yet my father got sick and wound up having to go to school. And so that got him some education. And as we all say, education can get you somewhere. It got my dad out of Trenton and wound up working for this small company called International Business Machines when he was a young man. And that wound up landing him a job with this gentleman named Howard Hughes, in Culver City at the time they were starting to design the computer center in the late 50s. And in Culver City at the Hughes Aircraft Station. And
so that's how he escaped from New Jersey to the West Coast.
That's it. And they moved here. And
how did he work closely with Howard Hughes?
You know, I don't know. My father passed away at 49 years old in 1975 of a blood clot in his brain. And this community was fantastic to be supportive of my mother, my sister, and I. And, you know, surrounded us. And unfortunately, we're unable to maintain our residence on La Cumbre for financial reasons. It was pre-Proposition 13. And the taxes alone did not enable my mom to be able to sustain keeping that home as a single parent. And so we sold that home and were able to buy another home up on Bienvenida. And we were able to be raised up there as we went to high school and survive up there. And my mom had a great life. And my sister and I were really privileged to be her children and to be supported by wonderful neighbors in this community, which is why I wanted to give back all the time to it.
Fantastic. So if you don't mind, let me go back to Howard Hughes, because he's such an iconic figure in the world. And I read his biography, or a couple of them. You didn't really get the opportunity to talk to your dad much about him. Is that what?
No, not really. I didn't. I knew what he did, and he moved on in the computer industries and worked on programs in time sharing when they were creating mainframes. So corporations now today, we all have laptops. There's a laptop that's running your podcast today. Before, these took up huge amounts of space with air conditioning and elevated floors, so cables could run underneath them, and magnetic tapes and punch cards. And so I was exposed to all that as a young boy, as my father would drag me to the office with him. So it was kind of cool to just be dragged around like that. But it wasn't until I was in college, and interestingly, I was graduating from Loyola Marymount University, and as I had crossed the stage, a gentleman approached me, and he said, "Are you Sam Lagana's son?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, "You knew my dad?" And he says, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, what are you doing here?" And he said, "I work here at Loyola Marymount, but when I was a student here at Loyola, I worked for your father down at Hughes."
Oh, wow.
And as Loyola Marymount sits right above what is now Playa Vista, was right then Hughes Aircraft. And my dad, I guess, employed students to help on the computer systems. And so I was able to meet more men that had worked for him and learn a little bit more about what they did. So I did get to learn about what happened down at Hughes as they were building computer systems and things like that. And then my dad, as I said, went into mainframes, timesharing, while my mom was a school teacher in the Beverly Hills Unified School District.
Well, so I just found out that you and I share something. My dad died at an early age too, 56. And I'm sure we share that feeling of, God, wouldn't you like to have another conversation and ask him some of these things and other things that you never thought were going to happen, because you didn't think there was any rush, because you assumed he was going to live forever, and then suddenly they're taken away, and gosh, wouldn't you like to go back and ask him about some of those things?
Yeah, it's fascinating. My dad has never aged in my mind from 49 years old, so he is still a younger man than I am today, and yet we are so fortunate to live in this community where he had so many good friends, and I've been able to stay in relationships with those friends and that are still in this community. And it seems when I talk to them that, you know, perhaps he is still alive through them. And it's wonderful just to have that kind of experience, to grow up in the town that you were raised in, or to live in the town that you were raised in. Is kind of neat. So my dad figured out this was a good place to live, because so many defense workers and school teachers lived here back in the 50s and the 60s. It was a dominant population, defense workers, if you will, from Douglas and Hughes and Northrop and the different places. And then many of their wives were school teachers and stuff like that. So this was a dominant culture of our community. And I just had to figure out how to afford the wheel.
Do you have any idea what they paid for their house on La Cumbre?
Oh, I can tell you this. I know what we sold the house for in about 1976. We sold it for about $250,000. And
lot value is probably $3 or $4 or $5 million right
I
now.
I would think that based on what I have learned, it's probably up in that range.
Yeah.
It hasn't changed when I drive by the house. And it's a distinctive home with many of the amenities, and just the flooring and the counters were terrazzo and marble, and the roof was so much of it was imported from Belgium, Italy, and different parts. It had a bomb shelter because that was the culture of the time.
Right.
So it was cool. And the swimming pool is still there that my father, you know, put in. I remember him cleaning the windows. We had these wonderful pane glass windows. And he was up cleaning the windows on a ladder one day. And fortunately, he didn't ask anyone to assist him. So he had no one stabilizing the ladder. And when he fell, not only did he fall to the ground, he fell into the hole that they were digging in the pool. And he damaged his backbone. And so he was laid up for a little bit while. And then I had to clean the windows. And it was all okay. But, you know, you realize those moments. So, you know, to be able to know that swimming pool is still there, it actually is a different significance to me. Or I remember when we had to drain the pool to clean it one time, and I came home and all my buddies were at the house skateboarding in the backyard in the pool because they knew that we were draining the pool.
My dad was a builder, so out in the valley, so periodically when I'm there, I'll drive by the buildings that he built, and it gives me that same feeling of he's still around in some way.
It was cool. I was at a reception at the home next door, and I as a young boy, Mr. Komsky lived in that home, Bernard Komsky, who owned piano stores. And one time they were going on vacation, they asked me to watch the home, keep an eye on it, walk around. And I remember walking around one day and seeing a shattered back door while they were gone. And I had to report, you know, that. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have a way to get a hold of people back in those days. And so, you know, we just had to figure out how to board it up and hope that nobody else was going to steal anything more. I remember having to report that to Mr. Komsky, that somebody had broken into their home. And so I was at that home and I was thinking about that the other day, and I looked over the wall to look at the pool, you know, and it's just some incredible memories.
Yeah, it reminds you of your dad. I can relate to that. So how old were you when your dad passed away?
I was 13.
Okay. And then sometime after that, you moved up to Bienvenida.
Yeah, a little bit over a year later, my mom figured out that this tax situation wasn't working out well for her. This pre-Proposition 13 was complicated because it was based on the, you know, the highest tax points of the neighborhood. And there was a beautiful home that had an elevator, and I think it was like almost an acre lot on our street. And so our taxes were high. So Proposition 13 changed a lot of that stuff. But my mom needed to have an exit strategy before that, and she did. And it gave her actually a little bit more freedom and freed things up for her. And as I said, her friends were phenomenal, and the support that we had from our church and our friends at church.
Corpus Christi?
Yeah, at Corpus Christi. And
why did I think you were Catholic?
I don't know. Italian? Yeah.
I just took a wild stab at that.
Yeah, could be.
So I don't know if you could – this is probably a question that's unfair to ask, but – looking back on the time that you were raised in the Palisades, how has it changed?
Wow, that's a great question. You know, while everybody says, oh, it's changed so much, you know, you can't look at buildings as a change. You have to look at the context of the people. And really, the context of the people have not changed. Now, maybe the bodies and the hair and those things have changed. But really, when people come to live in this community, they're coming for the same reasons that the people came in 1927 when the community was founded by the Methodists. They're coming the same reason they came in the 50s, the same reason that they came in the 80s. You come for a sense of community. You know, it's a wonderful place to raise a family.
Absolutely.
Sidewalks, streets best that you can play in, parks and recreation, a beach that you can access, the opportunity to go to the grocery store and know maybe a quarter of the people that are in that grocery store. And I think that's been great. Now, what Mr. Caruso is about to do is such an exceptional gift to our community because it'll foster a deeper sense of community in so many different ways. And yet we have also had those. But the evolution of our community from vibrance on Via de la Paz across from, you know, the elementary school at one time to vibrance being on Bowdoin, or if I guess it's Antioch at that point there, to Swarthmore having relevance. We've had relevance in different places, even on Sunset when the movie theater and the hot dog show were here. Different parts of the community. So you do get some change, but again, it's the core of the people. So Well, we had Mort's for so many years. What's filling that void for this next generation? Beach Street's doing it for some people, or a different restaurant. And then when Mr. Caruso introduces the different kinds of things we'll have, that next generation is going to have their own homes and their own places that place into their lives. But they're still going to have the PBBA. They're going to still have the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts and the YMCA. They're still going to have the high school and the elementary schools where we could use as playgrounds.
And that sense of community, which, you don't see people around here honking on the horn very much. You don't see people driving aggressively because you're going to see those people everywhere. You want to look out for one another. And
you
not...
don't see paparazzi. You True. Really
well,
don't.
Well, except for the July 4th parade, you do.
Okay,
a
little bit. But
Once
let's take one day when we invite the world to come to our town.
Right, right.
But outside of that, visit Malibu and just drive by Nobu.
Are you excited about Madeo's coming?
You know, I can't tell you that any one particular restaurant's going to excite me because, quite frankly, I'm not going to give up on Vittorio's.
Never give up on Vittorio's. Shout out to Vanessa Pellegrini.
I like Italian food.
My doctor would love for me to like it less. Mexican food and Italian food are good. I want Dave to have Canned Dave's back open.
Dave's a good friend
of
mine.
I love it.
He's opening, I think, within a month.
And driving to Culver City is a pain. So I'm looking forward to some good Mexican food back in the village.
Yeah.
You can go up to Casa Escobar.
Yeah, you can go up there.
I'm looking forward to that whole thing.
Can also go to one of my favorites, which is Gilbert's, which is one of the oldest restaurants in Santa Monica.
Yep.
And those guys do a great job. In fact, after the Rams games, I generally go to Gilbert's and have dinner there. Cash only, though. Don't think that you're going to
get a Gilbert's?
26th and Pico.
I feel ignorant.
I've been there many times.
Second oldest restaurant in Santa Monica.
Oops.
or as I like to call it, Pacific Palisades South.
So I have a question. Back when your family, when your dad was working at Hughes, and there were a ton of people in the defense industry living here, was it considered back then like a sort of a she community in the way that it is today?
No, it was middle class. I mean, you got to think about the evolution of the city of Los Angeles, really. So our city is really a young city in the greater Los Angeles area. So that first wave of immigrants that came from the East Coast, those the working class of all different ethnicities, because really you go into cities like Trenton or Philadelphia or New York or Boston, and they were enclaves of different ethnicities and races into different cultures. When they moved west, they didn't really assimilate into their own cultures. They moved to convenience areas to be close to their work, their workstations. So then you move into the 50s, and then people start, suburban sprawl starts, and they start moving to the west side, or they move to the valley. So you really had still a real working class mentality when that first generation of people that started to move out to this area.
And what was the, in that day, what was the equivalent? Would it have been Beverly Hills or?
Well, Beverly Hills was probably considered the, the she part of the town, maybe even a little bit more Bel Air. I don't think Bel Air was fully, developed at that time. Certainly there was not that little village they have up at the top of the hill. But, you had some really nice, Hancock Park was a dominant. Ladera Heights was a rising dominant community at that time. You had a number of parts of Pasadena, San Marino. All were part of the greater landscape of the Los Angeles area, which I think are all still relevant. And we've just flushed them in different ways as time comes. We still have probably more bungalow homes here than people would ever imagine. We're not really a community of 6-bedroom, 5-bath houses. We have a lot of homes on those alphabet streets and over in the Via.
Those bungalows on the alphabet streets are going quickly.
They go, but they're still there. If you can drive up and down on those 60-foot lot faces, 90-foot deep, that's what we got. That's how it was built. And, I think people are concerned about mansionizing and so forth. But the reality is it's still the dominant home. When you drive in there, there's still a lot of those bungalow homes that are there.
Yeah.
Hey, Steve, Why don't we take a quick break here and then come back and you can talk about Sam's community service and the details of that. Seems like a good point to take a break. And a shout out to Trish Bow, insurance agent at State Farm, and all the great car insurance and house insurance and every other kind of insurance you could need that she provides. And we so appreciate her support in this early time of our podcast. And also to Keith McElhan and our engineer producer from the Young Angels Network Producers Incubator. Thanks for all you do. If you want to support us and support Keith, you can go to www.youngangelsnetwork.org and donate a few shekels. Always appreciate it. It helps us pay for engineering and our post. So now we'll go back to you, Steve.
So, Sam, before we get on to community service, I just want to put together a few pieces. You move up to Bienvenida. You went to school here in the Palisades. Where'd you go?
Palisades High.
Okay. And you, when did you graduate?
I finished in 1980.
Okay. And then on to, you mentioned Loyola.
Went to Loyola Marymount University as an undergraduate.
Okay. And finished there?
Finished there.
And then I know you recently got an MBA.
Yeah.
But before then, you've done a lot of other stuff. So let's let's try to... You mentioned, or I mentioned, that you're currently the Associate Vice Chancellor at Pepperdine.
Yes, sir.
Tell us about what you do there.
Well, Pepperdine's a phenomenal place. And it's been
I teach at the law school, so
it's just a great asset to the communities that it serves. And for the last 15 years, I'm in my 16th year now at Pepperdine. At Pepperdine, I'm involved in development, fundraising, and building some of our constituents, whether it's in our alumni relations, our friends, our parents, and I have the opportunity to travel around our greater Los Angeles area as well as our nation and sometimes the world to help steward those relationships, to help people that want to make a difference in the life of America or the world in that way by making giving something a part of their life. And so the philanthropy that people extend to the university enables us to take monies, put them back into the educational environment, educating the next generation, or putting them into programs which will help us learn more and spread the good news of education.
How did you get into that?
So sports was really the launch pad.
Right.
Coming out of college,
college to Pepperdine, maybe you need to fill in a little blanks.
It's kind of a crazy scenario because you just don't know what you don't know, and you don't know how you're ever going to progress. But at Loyola Marymount, I wound up, because of some interest in the game of volleyball, I wound up with some friends that were starting the Association of Volleyball Professionals, and they invited me to kind of spearhead marketing, some marketing promotional public relations, just a recreational player, nothing significant. No St. John Smith level of significance or Karchi Karai by any means, but I enjoy the game. And so I had worked in the athletics department to help pay for my education. And so lo and behold, I got offered this opportunity to do promotions, public relations. And all of a sudden, we're starting this AVP in, 84, 85.
You were on the ground floor.
I was in the ground floor and needed somebody to sort of announce. And so, hey, you could do that. You were doing some of the announcing because I got hurt playing sport. And so the coach at high school, Coach Marvin, said, hey, why don't you know what you're doing, so why don't you sit down and announce some of this game? And in college, the same thing happened. And I tried out the volleyball team. I got hurt. I couldn't make it. And so they said, why don't you announce the game? And so that kind of led to 20-some years announcing volleyball. But I never took that seriously. I was always scared because, I had lost my dad at a young age, and I knew the value of needing to have an income and having resources. And so I wanted to prioritize my education and work. And so I did that. And so it was fun to help kind of launch that.
So what did you do for money? What did you do for work?
Well, that was it. Doing the promotions and public relations for the AVP. I drew a salary I was able to draw funding through announcing on that. And then in the off seasons, I would do things like have a Santa Claus business. And my friend from high school, Jeannie Buss, her dad had taken over the operations of California Sports and the Forum. And so she would hire me to announce some events. But then we started talking about the Santa Claus thing. And so I staffed Santa Claus at the Forum, you know, when I was a young man during the off season. So I had some extra revenue when we weren't in the summer playing volleyball.
I'm sorry. What do you mean you staffed Santa Claus?
I went and bought a bunch of Santa Claus suits. We're sitting in the Wells Fargo Bank in Pacific Palisades, but this is not the original location. The original location was on Swarthmore, and Ed Jones was the manager when I was a young man. And I was always fascinated. And Ed lived in Baldwin Hills and was just a great manager in our community. And so I talked to him about things I was trying to do. And I said, well, I've got this idea and about starting a Santa Claus business because I need to do something to get some money during, you know, the winter. And he helped me out, and I bought a bunch of Santa Claus suits. And then I went and got a bunch of students from college and made them Santa Claus, you know, different ethnicities to support different cultures, and put them in Santa Claus suits and sent them out. And
what, and they were like, you rented them out for
Santa
people
Claus.
That wanted Santa
Well, not
Claus.
Like a taxi.
You booked them for malls and events.
Yeah,
and
but it, for the Forum on every night of the week for Laker games. So it was kind of fun, or they went to people's homes. And as you got closer to Christmas, the cost
you were
went
Santa
up.
Santa pimp.
And, yeah, it was great, you know, and Santa could deliver people's gifts to their homes. And so it was just an idea that sort of worked.
Wow.
But I stole it because my mother's father was a Santa Claus in New Jersey when he was a younger man. So we have a giant picture of Santa Claus, black and white picture of Santa Claus at Christmas time in our home. It's actually my grandfather on my mother's side that we have this picture of. So I didn't invent something. I just sort of, well, maybe that's a way that I could make some money from here to here. And so that's what I did when I was younger. And then I got the rights to putting on some volleyball tournaments like at the time it was called the California Intercollegiate Volleyball Association. And that became the Western Intercollegiate Volleyball Association. It's now the Mountain Pacific Sports Federation. But I would get the rights to put on that event so I could make some money from like February to April, which is when we started the beach volleyball tour. So I just figured out a way to sort of make money, because until Pro Beach Volleyball, I mean, it was a startup. You didn't know what
right.
we were doing right or wrong.
Right.
You know, people think you start a business and all of a sudden somebody gives you a boatload of money and you have, you know, millions of dollars. No, you piecemeal until you could figure out how to get the business going.
That's what we're doing right here.
Pay attention, young angels. Pay attention.
That's what we're doing with the Palisades podcast.
And you just keep praying that somebody's right. going to keep giving you money. We had Miller Brewing Company and Jose Cuervo. We were able to partner with NBC Sports. And for me, it's been a blessing because so many of these people that I developed relationships with back in 1985, 86, 87, 88, 89, 90, I'm still friends with these people. And as I tell my students when I teach a class, I'm like, look around you. Because you never know what the guy or gal sitting next to you is going to be doing in 25 years. But if you develop a relationship today, you may well have that relationship 25 years later if they can trust you and you can trust them.
Well, you mentioned casually a relationship with Jeannie Buss.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't know whether you had any idea at the time that she was going to be who she was, but there's certainly a relationship that couldn't hurt your sports career.
Well, so... No, but she was a friend. I mean, I went to junior high
that.
And her dad was just an engineer when, like many other dads in the defense industry, he worked at Douglas.
No, I realize that. I'm not saying you cultivated it.
No,
but
no,
it turns
just,
out that you end up being friends with somebody who was
right.
very successful.
It's really funny. And I look at many of my friends. I mean, Chip England, who's the assistant coach of the San Antonio Spurs, or Steve Kerr, who now coaches the Golden State Warriors. You know, we all came from that same core group of people, you know, Eric Raspberry. There are just so many people that I'm still friendly with. Girls that were on the cheerleading team, Frida at Pally High at the time. You know, you it's amazing. People, whether they lived here, lived in Baldwin Hills, Ladera Heights, that we went to high school with, because Pally was a diverse high school when I was there. We had nearly 1,000 kids in our class, and they came from, I wouldn't say as many zip codes as they come from today, but I would say we probably served 10 zip codes at that time, but it was predominantly Ladera Heights, Baldwin Hills, kind of the Crenshaw, Lamerick Park area, and then the Palisades, Brentwood.
How would you say that sports at Pally has changed since you were there, if you think it has?
Well, I can only know what I know through the Palisades Post or the Palisades News or going once in a while now, but I am blessed. I mean, let's face it, I'm blessed to have grown up in this town at the time I was, and to go to that high school where a dominant amount of our community went to school, or, you know, even from the other people. But when you look at the kids that we were all in school with and what they did, Jay Schrader goes on to win a Super Bowl, right?
Played at UCLA first.
Right, and played PBA baseball. But other kids like Forrest Whitaker that we went to high school with, you know, he goes on to be one of the greatest actors in American history. You know, and these are all people that you interact in, and people don't realize that Forrest Whitaker played football at Pali High, and his first big major film was Fast Times at Ridgemont High, playing a football player. So it's kind of classic. And some of the kids that we just grew up with, they all have gone on to do so many, well, not I can't say all of them, but yeah, many of them have gone on to do so many really cool things. But you don't know at 17 or 15 years old. All you know is this a good person that I want to continue to have a relationship with if I can? And many you don't, you may not talk to for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, but some you wind up there. And I mean, even in this modern technology, I'm texting and tweeting and mm-hmm. and phone calling with, you know, some of my friends. And you know, I'm so proud of Jeannie for what she's accomplished, because she's just been a great leader. I mean, her dad gave her a chance. I was honored that she said, hey, will you announce my sporting events and help me with promotions early on team tennis and team cup volleyball and stuff like that. But you could see she had a great leadership. And then for her dad to sort of entrust her with the family legacy and the respect that she gets from her family members as well. And Janie's done a great job with the foundation and, you know, with obviously a little complication with her brother leading some of the basketball operations. But she had to make a tough decision. But she is so strong in quality that she's capable of that. And you know, again, when we met, she was the daughter of a guy worked at Douglas.
Yeah, yeah. You never know. You never know who's going to be incredibly successful or who's not going to make it.
Right.
And you go to a 10, 20, 30-year reunion, and you see people, and you think, whoa, I didn't think he or she would turn out that way, good or bad.
Our sound engineer could wind up winning an Academy Award or a Grammy someday, right? Who knows?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we pick winners for our incubator, and Keith and I met at ABC Radio when I saw him engineering a show. So that's pretty close to what I'm expecting is going to happen with him.
There you go. See?
Yeah.
So let me get you back, because I your story is fascinating, and you've had so many honors and so many things you've achieved. So you're putting together a living doing volleyball, Santa Claus, announcing different sports,
yeah,
and things like that. And did that kind of, how did that end up with you working for Pepperdine?
In development. Yeah. So sports, you know, you're constantly having to raise money. Okay. Corporate partnerships. You're doing it here on your podcasts. You create revenue in some way. And so that led to, as I mentioned, I put on these NCAA West Regionals in volleyball.
I've been to some and, of them. I'm a former
I did one at Cal State Northridge, and the athletic director approached me and said, well, this is really working out well. We want to go to Division I. Would you like to be a part of that? And I started thinking, well, that would be kind of cool. And so I left the AVP full-time and kept just doing the announcing and maybe some ghostwriting on the public relations side, and went to Cal State Northridge as an assistant athletics director. And that was great.
That's where Keith got his BA and his master's.
Awesome. It's a great school, and it serves its community phenomenally. I mean, when you look at the footprint, it's got the San Fernando, Simi, Conejo, Santa Clarita, and then all of the upper, the upper desert up in Lancaster and Antelope Valley that it serves. It's an amazing school, and it does a lot of good things. So I was blessed to be part of the experience that moved that school from Division II to Division I, and that led to, a change to Cal State Dominguez Hills, where I served in a more advanced role and handled the duties of athletics director. And having served there for a while, I received a phone call from Steve Hathaway from the Los Angeles Athletic Club, who invited me to come serve as athletics director, executive director at the Los Angeles Athletic Club. And I had met Steve as a young man, because after my father passed away, I was at Paul Revere Junior High. My mom was playing tennis, mostly out of the Palisades Park. But after we moved, she had just enough money that she could afford to join the Riviera so that she could be a little bit more scheduled. And, you know, it's tough as a single parent. And so this afforded her a little bit more built-in environment. And I was very fortunate that day that the Hathaways gave me a key to the back gate. So after junior high, I could get back over to Riviera, play some tennis, see my mom. But that led to a relationship with the Hathaways. So when I was at Loyola Marymount, I worked at California Yacht Club, which is part of the Los Angeles Athletic Club organizations, which at the time was Riviera, California Yacht Club, Los Angeles Athletic Club, the Pacific Coast Club, and there's a property on Catalina. And so they invited me to come to work with Hathaways. And so I got to do that. And that is where the John Wooden Award lived. And so I took some of the skills I had done and developed with beach volleyball and television with college. And we put together a plan for the John Wooden Award to become a televised event. And that allowed me to become executive director of that part.
As a lifetime Bruin fan, my dad having gone there and me having gone there, Wooden is one of those people that I put up in the upper pantheon of heroes in the world. And so anything that has his name on it, I'm in awe of it.
Well, and he's such a great guy. But when you look at all of these things that you do, there's just always so many people that surround you that support, you know, the activities. And so you're never alone. So it was always great people. And in this case, there was a guy named Duke Llewellyn, who was a friend of John Wooden's. Mm-hmm. And he's the one that created the award in 1976. And so to be able to partner with him and so many other people to help put then position the Wooden Award was a blessing. And then I received
a call.
Did
you get to spend time with John Wooden?
A lot. And that was really, really cool, because as a young man, I would, in fact, in 1970, in my office in Pepperdine, I have a picture of Coach Wooden that he signed in 1976. And then I have a picture of Coach Wooden that he signed in 1996. And he signed it exactly, not knowing that I had the other one, he signed it the exact same way. And it's amazing his consistency.
And you didn't change a bit in those 20 years as far as the photos, right?
You know, Sam, thank you for your interest, comma, John Wooden. And they're both up because they're so many years apart. So it was really, really cool to put those together. And that led to Pepperdine had reached out to me and started to evaluate that. And I wanted to spend some time and give back. And Michael Josephson reached out to me, and so I decided to spend some time on an ethics program called Character Counts in sports. And I spent some time in college basketball because we had a relationship with the NABC and we developed a program there. And then I went to Pepperdine and we're doing development, and that's where we're at. Brooke?
Yes, I have a question, Sam.
Yes.
I heard through the grapevine that you recently completed, at your ripe old age, an MBA program.
Yes.
What prompted you to do that, and what was it like, and what are you going to do with it? And well, I also heard you went to India, and we want to hear about that.
Oh, thanks, Brooke. Yeah, you know what? When you get into your middle ages, if you will, if we hope that this is our middle age, right? My grandfather lived till he was 99. My father's sister, who was my aunt and godmother, she lived to 102. While my dad made it to 49, my great-grandmother, 99. I'm hoping that I got that good gene that keeps going, right? So I figure I'm somewhere in the middle right now, and I wanted to know what I didn't know, as I sort of alluded to earlier. And things are moving fast in our world. You know, they're a lot faster. So I wanted to be able to look in the rearview mirror and make sure I had all the blind spots filled too. And so, you know, about a year and a half ago, I ventured into it, and I was fascinated by some of the people that had already gone through this particular program. It's called the Presidential Key Executive MBA at Pepperdine.
Is this at the Grazia Deo School?
It's at the Grazia Deo School. And so I was fascinated by some of the people that had gone through it. And, of course, because of my relationship at the university, I had met a number of the professors.
Probably got a break on the tuition just a little bit.
You know, it's an interesting thing. You do get a little bit of a break, but then the government wants taxes on whatever the break is giving you.
Okay.
So don't think that there's – I think I would have rather, as I've said, I would have rather paid the university than paid Uncle Sam, but we paid Uncle Sam.
Okay.
And for a portion, and we did pay the university for a portion. But it was well worth it because some of the professors were just so outstanding, and they give you an opportunity to push yourself. And that's what it's about. You know, you get into the age that I'm at, in these middle ages, if you will. And most of the people in my program, there were nine of us in this program. One is the president of Blue Cross Blue Shield. We have a woman who is just an extraordinary entrepreneur. And then another fellow who is the CFO of a manufacturing company in Texas. An immigrant from Korea who had started a healthcare business. A gentleman from Glendora who had started a compounding pharmacy. So just some really interesting people. And then we're each challenged to develop a capstone, which becomes basically like a dissertation on one element. It could be on your business or something that interests you, and you have to get it approved by the professors. And mine was on nonprofit philanthropic leadership. And so I generated a 194-page document doing the research on organizational behavior, economics, finance, marketing, and strategy of how to put together a program that could assist people in their desire to be more significant in nonprofit philanthropic leadership. There's so many people I meet that are like, well, how do you get to be on a board, or what do you do on a board? And I started realizing that people want to have more significance, but there's not really good training for the person that wants to be on a board. There's training for people that could go manage the board, the executives, but there's not training for how to teach people to be board members or how to coach boards to be better at what they do.
Or how to, for those people, to find boards that might
exactly.
be looking for somebody.
And so I decided I could draw upon my skills that I have developed over all these years of being involved in development and put them together and do more research. And so I did that. And one of the trips, as you alluded to, Brooke, was to travel to India and with my cohort. And so Maurice Smith, who's the president of Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Illinois, he and myself and Hyun Lee, who is the entrepreneur or founder of these healthcare facilities and throughout the greater Los Angeles and Southern California region, we went to India and with one of our professors, Bill Smith, and we had just an extraordinary experience meeting with the leaders of Tata organization, their chief strategist.
That's a car manufacturer, right?
Well, they have car manufacturer. They have everything you can imagine. It's probably one of the largest conglomerates in the world. And Tata is a very, very recognized worldwide leader in business. And then we also had the opportunity to go to Marunda. I met with the federal, not alone, of course, with these gentlemen and the professor and students, with the Federal Reserve Bank of India. And so it was just fascinating. We were in Mumbai, and while we were there, it was the celebration of the Ganesh. And so I got to learn about the Hindu experience, and those people were very welcoming. And so I got to experience the Hindu temple and the experience of the celebration of the Ganesh. And right next door to the Hindu temple was a mosque, so I was invited in to experience what was going on in the mosque. It also happened to be about the time when Mother Teresa was being named Saint Teresa. And so I went to the Catholic Church there, and there were 10,000 people lined up to celebrate her sainthood at that time. So it was just extraordinary, beside looking at the caste system and then meeting with these people as to what they're doing. And they're going to be building 20 new, six new cities for 20 million people each in India, and building up, you know, manufacturing. They have, you know, 1.3 billion people in India, and we have 330 million people in the United States. So it's a fascinating place, and it was just extraordinary to be able to experience it at the level that we did for those 10 days.
That was your first time in India?
Yes.
How long were you there?
About seven days or so.
Where did you stay?
we stayed at a very nice hotel in the middle of Mumbai. It was a St. Regis, but it had just recently rebranded. But it was a fascinating place because while you went into the driveway, what it was on the outside of the driveway were oxens and, you know, different kinds of dwellings. And then you had this incredible hotel and a mall. but anybody was welcome in the mall, but nobody that maybe didn't feel comfortable in the mall didn't go into the mall. But our hotel was attached to the mall.
And then when you fly into Mumbai, you fly over one of the largest slums anywhere in the world. It just goes on endlessly, and yes, it's side by side with a modern airport, yes, with the modern buildings. It's an incredible transition, more than any place.
It's crazy. And that slum, by the way, is not the worst place to live in India.
Yeah, I know.
That's one of the higher points. Not the highest, obviously, but it's just amazing. It's an amazing place, and it was a great experience.
Did you come back with a sense like you want to do something to help people in India and elsewhere because of an affinity for the country?
I came back with a more affinity of what I'm trying to accomplish here for the people here,
mm-hmm,
can be significant, because these people can then determine where they want to change the world.
How does your MBA impact your current job?
Well, I think it's giving me more vision. As I said, I wanted to see the blind spots, and I feel like I filled in some of those. And I think I'm able to drill down on really the value system and how I can help people more to achieve what they want to achieve. I mean, that's one of the great things I get to do, is I get to help people realize what they want to accomplish and help them accomplish their dreams and walk them through that process of accomplishing their own dreams. And it's given me a better understanding of maybe how they created some of their significance and how they can take that significance and make it more vital.
Okay. Right. So I couldn't, as a lifetime sports fan, not ask you about being the stadium announcer for the Rams. That came about through all of your sports connections, I assume?
Yeah, it was kind of a weird thing. I guess, we all heard that the Rams were coming back in that January, and I think we were all pretty excited about the fact that. So I, like maybe you did, and maybe many others that are listening to this podcast, I submitted to buy some season tickets, and I got fortunate. I was able to buy season tickets. I was excited about that. I was going to have season tickets, because one of my fondest memories of my dad was going to the Coliseum, and we sat in, I could tell you, we sat in section 5, and we were probably about row 38 for a Chicago Bears game. And in my garage, I still have that program from going to the game, because I've saved some things that, were my dad's and mine, just to have those memories. Not a lot, but I have a few. And so the Rams were something that was real to me as a young guy. And when they moved to Orange County, that was tough on me, because they could have been moving to India, as far as I was concerned, going to Orange County.
Right.
And, I could get there, and I even had a car, but I went there twice during the time that they played in Anaheim and sort of just wasn't excited about driving down to Anaheim or back. Nevertheless,
and then
they come
moved
back
to St. Louis,
right,
and
then they
really
were gone, and
put the knife
whatever
in the back.
But, you kind of followed them from afar, because I remember Bob Klein, being a Ram, and him sitting in front of me at church. And, he's 6'5", probably 260 at the time. And just, he was a stud. And he was a Ram, and I remember that. And I'm 6'5". And, I just remember those days vividly. And I have so much respect and regard for Bob. And so I remember when I heard the Rams were coming back, I was just so excited. And so I got those tickets. And, people would say, hey, are you going to announce the Rams? I'm like, yeah, right. I would love to do something like that. And I really didn't go too crazy, but, just sort of, hey, that'd be kind of fun, right? Well, I got an email in May that said, hey, would you like to be considered as an announcer for the Rams?
Just came out of the blue?
No. An email from this guy. I thought I was getting what's called being punked today. And I thought I was getting punked. So I thought it was one of my friends setting me up, because it was just out of the blue. No phone call, just an email. And so it said, if you'd like to just record these 6 lines and send it back to us. And so I responded. I was like, great, thanks. I can't get to a studio. I called my wife to see if I could. My wife Eileen works in post-production of film and television, and her office is in Burbank. And so I called her. I said, is there any way I could, rent some time in the studio and do a voiceover in your studio? And she said, I don't think I can get you until next week. But I'm sure we can find some time in there. And so I wrote them back, I can't get to a studio till next week. And they said, just record it on your iPhone. And I'm like, oh yeah, like this is for real. I couldn't believe that this would be for real. But so I tried it in my office and it didn't sound very good on the iPhone.
And what, you were just doing like a mock play-by-play?
They gave me seven lines, you know.
I see.
And so I tried it there and it didn't sound good. So I went to the bathroom and I tried it in the bathroom because I, you know, sometimes you practice in the shower. And so I thought, well, maybe the bathroom at work might work because of the tiles and stuff. It did not sound good. But there's this little corridor between the bathroom and the hallway. And I thought, well, this could sound good because the carpet and the dead walls and the right, you know, ceiling tile. So I tried it on my iPhone. And so I recorded it on my iPhone there. And I was like, well, I'll just record this and I'll send it in. And we'll see what happens because I'm just not sure that this is really real anyhow. And so I did. But I wasn't happy because I was concerned that it wasn't good quality. And so I sent it to them and I didn't hear anything. And so I recorded it, you know, on that following Tuesday and I sent it to them and I still didn't hear anything. So I just kind of waited. And then in July, on the same day, you know, basically 2 months later, I'm at Guido's down in Santa Monica, on Little Santa Monica, and we're right off Santa Monica. Yeah, and Bundy there. And one of my buddies says to me, hey, whatever happened with that Rams thing? And I said to him, you know, if I don't really hear anything soon, I'm there's just no way I could be able to do this because this, you know, school year's starting. I'm going to be going to India and I got to make my plans around this because my trip to India would conflict with some games. So I hope I hear from him. But if not, then no big deal. It was, you know, I got season tickets and I'm excited to go. So I go out to the parking lot to get my car, which is a valet parking there. And I get my car and I get an email at like, whatever, 10 o'clock at night that says, we'd like you to consider being the voice of the Rams in the stadium.
Wow.
I was like, okay, which guy at the table did this?
Yeah.
You know, I'm still not convinced. So I was pretty jumping up and down. I was pretty like, you got to be kidding me. And so I wrote to Chris, who is the producer and in charge. And I said, hey, I'll come over and visit you tomorrow at your office. And that's what I did. And then we locked everything up and boom, less than a month later, I'm announcing the Los Angeles Rams with 91,000 people.
Wow.
Amazing.
On that note, I think we should call it. And I believe Keith has a question for our guest.
Yeah, I did have a question because it seems like throughout your career, you got a lot of opportunities. Did you ever have to apply to any of these jobs, or are they just like, was it just all networking connections, especially for my generation? Because, you know, with the degrees, we believe application is how you get it done. But apparently that's not the only way. So was it just by sheer being yourself and making connections?
Keith, I would tell you that life is all about relationships. When I go into my class, when I teach a class, I always put a sign up first that says, life is about relationships. And I believe that. So do I have to apply? Yeah, eventually you have to fill out the application. But somebody tells you, hey, we think you should fill out the application. And so that's good. But yeah, you know, in my lifetime, sure, I've had to fill out those applications. I think getting the job at the Bay Theater, I had to fill out an application, although the manager asked me. I remember Dennis Addy was the manager of the Bay Theater. Then he asked me because I was working at the park. And he said, hey, would you be interested? You should fill out an application. But yeah, you know, I think that you have the opportunity to visit with people. And I would always encourage, I know we get into all these texting and tweetings and everything's so computerized and everybody's driving for this. But I wholly believe that it's people we know and relationships that we have that are what help you advance, because I want to help other people be successful. That's what I love to do day to day. And I believe that that's what other people get gratification in as well.
And one thing I have to mention that you and your wife and your two daughters still live in the Palisades, right?
Yeah, we do. I don't think we plan on going anywhere, but it's just a lovely place to live. We got some great neighbors, and many of my neighbors have been here. My next door neighbor is a guy who built the house that he lives in, and across the street, you know, they've been in the neighborhood for, you know, probably 40 years. And, you know, so it's nice, you know, it's always fun to see when new people move into the neighborhood to see how they decide that they're going to figure out how they're going to fit into the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And some fit in really well and some just sort of don't. But I like it when they do.
It's a matter right of how on, much effort
Sam,
you put in.
Right on. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's really been a pleasure.
And I would just add that I feel like we could spend another couple hours and we still wouldn't have mined everything about your experience and your views. But you are the kind of person that makes the Palisades what it is, the community, a sense of caring for one another. And it's been delightful for me to have you with us today.
Well, thank you both. It's been a great experience, and we are all very fortunate to be in one of the best places in the world.
We all agree on that.
Rock on, Palisades. Bye for now.
And with that,
we're out.
We're done.
Young Angels Network out.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward, but who says you can't get something for yourself too? Now when you buy vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.